All right, so first I'm going to start with thanking you guys for coming here instead of going next door. I know that's very interesting, choosing between me and Greg. When Greg Taylor is talking security, TMG, another interesting topic. So welcome. You know the topic, I'm interested in knowing how many of you actually have worked with RBAC beyond just using the defaults. Great. Okay. So no questions then, right? You already know stuff. I'm gonna start with my introduction first. I come from exchange background. I have been doing exchange for a long time. I continue doing that in my current role at Kemp Technologies. I'm actually looking after the research of our products. Before that, I worked for Microsoft and work for Microsoft Technologies in different roles. Worked with a lot of different technologies, but Exchange was my, let's call it, first love. And it has stuck ever since. It never goes away, right? You learn riding the bike and it just stays with you. So we are going to talk about RBAC in different ways. First of all, of course, understanding RBAC. I'm not going to bore you with the details. I know you guys know what RBAC is, but we'll go into a little bit of details. We'll talk about what RBAC looks like in Exchange 2013, in Link 2013, and we're also going to talk about a little bit of process, real world, how you actually go about deploying RBAC. That one, depending on how we look at processes, might be interesting or boring, but just stay with me if you can. So let's start with understanding RBAC. How many of you know RBAC existed before Exchange 2010? All right. Yeah. One guy. Or maybe two. I saw one more hand. RBAC has interesting history. If you do search for RBAC, you would find stuff on, I forgot the name of the person who wrote it, but from Microsoft back in 2000, wrote a document that explains how to use RBAC with Authorization Manager, which is what you see here, ASMAN. How many of you know ASMAN from 2000? There you go, yeah. The idea is same as what you're using in Exchange, Link nowadays. The idea is to separate the store where you're storing your security objects, users and groups, from permissions, right? You're trying to achieve some access control for your given application, in this case, Exchange or maybe Link. When you're trying to gain that, what you're looking at is you're looking at your organization, you're looking at what different roles exist in the organization, who tends to do what, and based on that, you try to assign permission. Now, how many of you gave read-only access to one of your contractors in Exchange 2003 time? Anybody? Read-only? No. Was it read-only? Was it true read-only? You don't know. Or maybe, right? And out of so many people, it's just two guys who say they tried it and they gave read-only permission, or they think they gave read-only or view-only permissions, right? Why was it that hard? I mean, I'm sure most of you at least have worked before 2003, Exchange 2000 or 2003 and so on, right? Why was it so hard? It had built-in groups, right? You had built-in delegations. There were three with 2003. 2007 had some more. It gave you basically the permissions that were already assigned in Active Directory. You didn't have to go in DACLs. You didn't have to go to the OU permissions. You don't have to manage any of that. But if you wanted to, so how many of you have tried to do it yourself? By going to Active Directory, assigning the ACLs to meet some of your own requirements that Exchange couldn't do out of the box. A couple guys right there, there you go. How was that? Easy? Ugly? Right? Not fun? And that's the idea. The RBAC is trying to separate that out. It's trying to, one, of course, make it easy for you to assign the right set of permissions, but at the same time, decoupling that from Active Directory so you don't have that dependency of sorts. Especially in the bigger environments, you tend to see you have different groups. You have groups who are Active Directory, identity management, maybe tied to your SAP, your HR systems. Then you have different group who is managing your messaging, right? And sometimes they don't cross. You have identity management saying, you don't ever create a user in my Active Directory. The reason is simple sometimes, that you have set processes. You want to make sure the users are created a certain way, the life cycle is managed that way. RBAC allows you to still maintain control as Exchange guys to do your own thing without messing with the Active Directory permissions and so on. So anyway, we talked about, sorry, I'm just skipping a little bit too quick, but we talked about what the RBAC is, as we know it in 2010, 2013, Link 2010, Link 2013. What it's doing is it's allowing you to do the granular permissions. You get to assign permissions all the way to the commandlet levels, right? So you can create a custom role. You can take everything away and give someone access only to particular commandlets that they are supposed to have access to. In Exchange, you could even go a step further. You can even take away parameters. So you can give someone access to mailbox creation while taking away some of the parameters that might be more dangerous or disastrous, or for some reason you don't want them to use that. For an example, creating a mailbox, but you don't want them to define a certain mailbox database. You take that away, they can't use that parameter anymore. Right? So you have the granular control. Roles are now more closely mapped with what you're trying to do. In Exchange, when you launch Management Shell, or when you launch Exchange Management Console from 2010, or EAC in 2013, how many of you have looked at what actually happens in the backend? It's difficult to see what's going on in the backend. You don't see that, right? You fire up the PowerShell, and you see it bringing the commandlets in. How many of you actually use PowerShell remotely? Not Management Shell, right? Not installing the tools, just regular PowerShell and then connect to Exchange, right? Quite a few, that's good. You know how it works. You're basically connecting to the same framework. Are there any differences when you connect that way instead of using Management Shell? Okay, what do you see? I would say very simply, it breaks scripts. Right? That's the simple way to put it. There are many reasons, and I can go into a lot of details if we had a full day. But what happens is when you connect remotely, you're using regular PowerShell. You're connecting to Exchange. Exchange is giving you the commandlets, and you have access to it. But it's serialized. Now, if you know PowerShell in a little more detail, it's serialized. Then you have definitions. So the data that's coming from server, your PowerShell doesn't understand. It doesn't know what the megabyte and gigabyte is for in terms of when it's looking at the mailbox size, right? When it's looking at, I don't have a good example, but any of the other items that's coming from Exchange, let's say Exchange version. When you look at version, what does the version string look like? 15.1.x.y, right? Four numbers with dotted decimals. That's your major, minor, and revisions, and so on. When you're in Exchange Management Shell, you see Exchange version.major, and it would only spit out .15. Now run that script in PowerShell, and it would fail, right? Because there is no .major. The .major is defined because the object is defined as a version. In Exchange Management Shell, when you fire that up, it's reading the object definitions. In PowerShell, that doesn't happen. However, the idea is relating to this slide, all of your tools basically rely on the same set of commandlets that Exchange is surfacing to the user, right? When you fire up that shell or fire up that remote PowerShell or EAC, whatever, first it looks at who you are, which groups you're a member of, what permissions you have, and then which commandlets you have access to. That covers one part. The second part is, once you have access to create a mailbox, do you have access everywhere in the organization? Or do you have access to certain places? Right, so the scoping. It looks at that, and then it gives you access to that interface, whatever the interface is, PowerShell, EMC. And once you have that access, you go about doing your work. In that process, the process that I described, all that is done by the RBAC framework. So as you connect, RBAC framework looks at all that and gives you the access. And that's why all the tools from Exchange use remote PowerShell. And what I mean by that is when you log on to Exchange directly, whether it's physical or remote desktop, you fire up Exchange Management Shell. That's still leveraging the remoting the same way you would do from your PowerShell, except, of course, it loads other definitions and all the other stuff. But it still does remote. So it remotes either to itself, or if you have multiple Exchange servers, it would find one that's closest. Most of the times, it's itself. Now, how many of you have actually enabled PowerShell remoting for Exchange servers? And was that for any particular reason? Okay. All right, and that's good to hear. I didn't hear anyone saying because it's required. Right? And that's good. It's not required. You don't need PowerShell remoting for Exchange command list to work, for your PowerShell to connect remotely to Exchange. It does not use PowerShell remoting. It uses the framework. It does use the PowerShell framework, but it doesn't use the listeners you would create by enabling the PS remoting on the server itself. So just for connecting to Exchange, you don't need to enable PS remoting. And that's why that enumerate WinRM config, it won't return any listeners unless, of course, you enabled it manually for some reason, right? So then how does it connect to Exchange? What's the commandlet? Does anyone remember? Not exactly the commandlet, but where do you connect? What is it that you're pointing to? Which virtual directory? Right. So you're basically pointing to the URL HTTP or HTTPS, the server name and slash PowerShell, and then your session connects to that. It goes through IIS, through the app pool of Exchange PowerShell, which is tied into the RBAC, and that's how both the local and remote tools work. And here is that handy reference I was talking about earlier, right? Trying to give someone a read-only access. What you had from Exchange delegation were a few groups. In 2003, you had three. In 2007, you had five. In 2010, came along RBAC, and then you didn't have to worry about these groups anymore. But if you look at all those groups, what you see is those groups were defined based on certain categories, right? Public folder management, server management, somebody managing the servers physically, user management, recipient administrators, org admin always has access to everything. But again, all this was customized, you had access, based on the delegation, but the delegation was just a wizard that was assigning permissions on Active Directory, right? You were limited by what you can do there, because otherwise you would have to go back to that, what we talked earlier, ugly hacks, going into DACLs, looking at and understanding what permissions should be there, should not be there, and then if you had clustering enabled for any reason, you had that in the mix when you try to assign the DACLs and you find out the person can't access cluster to see the status. If you look at components, what does RBAC looks like logically, right? you have four different things. And in here, you might see five. What you see is those four boxes and a glue. Let me start with the far left. You have basically what you're trying to do, what you're trying to give someone access to, right? What is that in terms of exchange itself, or link for that matter? This remains same between exchange and link, right? So that's commandless, that's parameters, because that's how you do stuff, right? That's how somebody does the administration. When you're doing that administration, they have access to what? Commandlets and parameters. So that management role group is an entity that you know. When you do get dash management role group, you see a bunch of groups. If you go to Active Directory, you see those groups as well. And what those groups are is a security entity where you put users in, and they are tied to all the management roles. All the management roles give them access to the command list, to the role entries. And those role entries allow you to do things. So you put users in the groups. Groups have access to management role. Management role is comprised of your commandlets, parameters, what is called role entries, and that enables you to do stuff. But that's not all, because that only gives you access to commandlets. It doesn't account for the scope or account for people, right? So the people are up on the right. You have the administrators and users. They fall in a single bucket that I call who, right? You have administrators that manage entire organization or parts of the organization. You have OUs, or you have maybe scopes based on titles, based on locations, based on server groups, based on maybe certain databases, whatever your scope is. Administrators manage those portions that they're responsible for, right? And you assign them access to role assignments. Now, role assignments are same for administrators and users, but when you look at it from user perspective as an administrator, out of the box, if you didn't customize anything, you see one default policy, right? It's called policies because you're assigning it to the set of users, whether it's for everyone or just set of users. And that's why I have them separate. This is exactly how it's on TechNet for a reason. Your users, basically in Exchange Now, it allows you to do self-service. You can go to Outlook web app. You can go to options. When you go to options, you can modify certain things. Maybe your office, maybe your home address, maybe your phone number. It really depends on what you're allowed to do. If you have distribution groups, if you created a distribution group, you're the owner of the distribution group, you can manage membership of that. You can do that from there. That's all because those permissions are assigned to you by the policy, right? So it's the same thing. When you as a user do that, what is different from you doing something versus admin doing something is you're managing yourself. Administrator is managing a group of people or the entire organization, right? Actually, sorry, let me just come back to this one. The last portion where is interesting. What you have is you have different scopes. You have regular scopes and you have exclusive scopes, right? How many of you have used exclusive scopes? How many of you locked yourself out first time you tried it? It's difficult to lock yourself out when you're org admin, but what happens is when you create an exclusive scope, let's start with the scope first, and then you would understand what the exclusive is, right? When you do the scope, you're saying this administrator or this set of administrators will have access to this OU or this set of users or this set of servers and databases. When you create an exclusive scope, you're saying if somebody isn't assigned to it exclusively, right, explicitly, if you haven't actually selected someone and assigned to that exclusive scope, no one has access to that. So if you think of that in a different way, in Active Directory, if you assign permission on domain itself, on the top level, it inherits further down, right? Same concept here. With the regular scopes, if it is top-level scopes, then it would be everywhere, it's cumulative or additive. And that means you will have access to certain places where you as an organization may want to restrict that access. Let's call it executives, right? Blessings and pain of our existence. Anything that has to go wrong goes wrong with them, and what you want to do is limit that. You want to restrict who can edit their objects, who can manage them, who can modify their properties. To do that, you want to restrict access, and you want to make sure inheritance doesn't interfere with that. So you create an exclusive scope. When you create an exclusive scope and assign it to OU where the VIPs exist, or maybe look at the title, and anyone who matches certain title, give them the exclusive scope, and they would fall within that management entity. Once they fall in that entity, you will have to assign explicit permissions to it. You will have to pick a person or a group who has access to that role, regardless of inheritance. So even if you have overlapping roles which allows you access to that OU, you still won't be able to manage it because it's exclusive. So as an administrator, even if you're an org admin, when you create the exclusive role, you don't have access to it. You have access to modify the definition of that role. You do not have access to the objects that fall in that scope, right? And that's why I asked the question, how many of you actually locked yourself out? Everybody does. When you create that, you just locked yourself out until you actually modify who has access to it. It could be you, it could be someone else. All right, so the roles, commandlets, parameters, that's the what. In Exchange 2013, I was looking recently, I found about 83 predefined roles. So if you compare that to 3 and 5 from 2003 and 2007, you can tell a lot of work has gone in defining different categories of what people tend to do with Exchange, right? As Exchange matured and as the teams learned what people do with Exchange, they kept defining more roles. So Exchange 2013 comes with built-in roles, about 83 different ways of assigning permissions. That's built-in. On top of that, you have ability to customize that. So you can customize that to your taste. How do you see the existing roles? Get management roles, get management role entry. If you give it a role name, shows what commandlets and parameters that role gives access to. When you create the roles, how many of you have created custom roles? I saw a few hands before, right? When you created them, did you assign a parent? Is that a requirement? Yes, no? Okay, I get one no, others yes. So, in Exchange, when you create a custom role, you have to pick a parent, right? You have to have a parent, and the parent is basically, if it is a new setup, you just installed Exchange, it's all the built-in roles, right? Now, you can create a custom role, and then you have a sub-definition. You have, let's say, help desk leads. Now, these are the guys who are overlooking maybe a larger set of people who are actually doing the help desk work, right? In that case, you have the help desk leads who have higher authority than the help desk guys themselves. So what you can do is you can create a parent role. Well, first role, that is your custom role from the parent, whichever one you pick. Then you can create a second role, which uses your new custom role as a parent. So you can have the grandfather-parent-child relationship if you want to. And you can keep creating that chain. You can make it longer. Try not to do that, though, because what happens is it has a dependency, right? That parent cannot be modified once it has a child. That parent cannot go away once you have a child. So if you create a long chain, you would get in trouble when you try to modify those. Try to keep flat hierarchy as much as possible. That would help you in the long run. When you create the child, when you create a custom role, what can you do with it? We talked about customizing commandlets parameters. You can take them away or add them in. What you can add is what parent had that you have taken away. You can add them back in. You cannot add any commandlets that the parent did not have. So you created a role based on existing help desk role, and then you tried to assign it a commandlet that's not part of the parent, that's part of some other role. That's not going to work. It will just give you an error, right? If parent doesn't have it, child doesn't get it. It's kind of different when it comes to link, and we'll talk about that. But in Exchange, that's how it works. You can modify the child roles. You can take stuff away. So let's say you created the child role, take stuff away so that they have only commandlets they need now. Over time, that job role evolves, and now they have more responsibility. You want to give them those commandlets back. You can add them back. And that works fine. Now, I asked, is parent required, right? And I said yes. But my last line on the previous slide, if you noticed, was exceptions. There are always exceptions, right? And in Exchange, that is unscoped top level. What that role is it allows you to create what it just says right there, unscoped top level. It has no scope. You cannot assign a scope to it. It applies to entire organization. And it's top level, which means it has no parents, right? Which also means if you don't have a parent, what do you inherit? Nothing, right? It's like an immigrant, someone like myself, comes to US with $100 in hand. You have nothing. you just build upon that. The idea is unscoped top level is very powerful tool. It allows you to create custom roles based on your own definition. Let me give you an example. If you have a workflow, when you create mailboxes, very simple example. When you create mailboxes, you have a workflow where you want to make sure it has certain limits. It has a given address book if you're a hoster. Right, you want to segregate which address book they get. It has certain parameters. When you do that, you also want to, after the mailbox is created, immediately after that, you want to assign it certain policies, take away certain permissions, which isn't possible until after the mailbox is created. So now, instead of just a commandlet or a couple of commandlets, now you have a workflow, right? It's either defined by business or your IT needs, whatever that may be. Once you have that set of requirements, you create a script. You wrote all those commandlets, you created the script. What do you do from there? You give it to the guys who are doing it every day, right? Is that foolproof? Does it have problems? Yeah. People like me, we are always curious. If somebody gives me a script, the first thing I would do is open the script and see what it's doing, right? What commandlets it has, what the person is doing, how I'm going to run it. And then I always like to think I'm smarter than the guy who created that script. So I might just throw my own twist in it, right? Is that foolproof? You're trying to adhere to a business logic that you have, and it's not working if you do that. The other problem is when you give them access to that script, you just handed them a PS1 file. But that has commandlets that they have to run as a part of running that script. You will have to give them access to those commandlets, right? So once they have access to those commandlets, not only they can run the script, they can individually run those commandlets as well. Maybe sometimes that's not what you want. Maybe sometimes you just want to give them access to this one script that they can't modify, but they can run, and they don't have access to those individual commandlets, right? So unscoped top level helps you with that. It basically is an empty container. Then you can create your own scripts, or you can give them access to commandlets, not only Exchange, but outside of Exchange commandlets. You might have a reason for that. Sorry? Unscoped top level is not a parent. You could call it a custom parent. And basically, where you're going with that, I guess, is so that you can create other roles based on that role. You could, yes. So you could do that. You could create an unscoped top level. Then you can create all the commandlets and scripts that it's going to have access to. And then you can create the sub roles that will have access to part of those commandlets. Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't even have to be Exchange commandlets. It could be your Active Directory commandlets or some other commandlets. Anything that's installed as a module on the server where it's going to run from, which is Exchange server. Right. Right, so the difference there is the previous example of help desk that I was telling you, you already have built-in role of help desk, let's say. And those are the commandlets they are going to use. Then you don't want to create unscoped top level, right? The problem with unscoped top level is there is no scoping. Help desk might be limited to certain OU or certain location or certain servers. Unscoped top level is just that, unscoped, has no scoping. Right, so that may not be desired. That may not be what you are trying to do. Okay. So that's the difference. No, okay. Unscoped top levels don't. So let's jump into a quick demo. I'm going to show you how to create an unscoped top level. How many of you have actually created an unscoped top level role? Two hands, great. It's not bad if you haven't done it. There's always first time. Once you know what it is capable of, you'd probably want to do it. Just understand when to do it or when not to do it. And when not to do it is when I ask you a question, why did you create that? And you say, because I can. Although that's exactly what I did anyway, so I can't blame you. All right, we've got the bars. Okay. And the first things I'm going to look at this commandlet, how many of you can explain what that is doing? Get management role assignment, unscoped. Give me an FL star. FL is at least formatted as a list, right? But what is it going to tell me? I'm searching for all the role assignments that are unscoped. How many role assignments are there that are unscoped right now in my organization, right? And when I do that, it's going to spit out how many we have. And in my case, it's a basically out-of-box install of Exchange. So there isn't much to it except what you would notice is just one, right? Actually, it sounds like there are two. Okay. So one I have is unscoped role management for organization management, delegating. The other one is organization management, no delegating at the end. Do you know the difference between the two? Or let me show you something here. What you would see is role assignment delegation type called regular. If you look at the delegating, you would notice it's delegating org-wide. What is the difference between these two? As an org admin, I mentioned earlier, you have ability to assign permissions to others and yourself, right? That's delegation. You're delegating to someone, whether it's yourself or someone else. Delegating org-wide allows you to delegate permissions to others. If this was out-of-the-box setup, you would only see the first one. You would not see the next one down that shows the regular assignment. This regular assignment right here, that's because I created it. Out of the box, that unscoped top level is not assigned to anyone, including the org admins. And what does that mean? That means when you are at the shell and when you try to create No, I got to press Control C because I'm trying to do something out of script. So when you do new management role, you have a parameter called unscoped top level, right? What I did here is I hit tab. You didn't see it, but I hit tab. What does tab do? Tries to expand the parameter that you're typing. It didn't expand that parameter. And that's because I don't have access out of the box. Right? You saw that second assignment because I was running it, but I never closed that PowerShell, went out of it, and came back in. So if I try to create a new unscoped top level right now, it will fail. Even if it seems I have permissions, it will still fail. Because the permissions are evaluated when you start your session, not in between the session. So let's go back to that demo again. That one just shows me that. What I'm going to do is, you see the new management role, I'm trying to create one with unscoped top level as a parameter. So it's going to create a blank empty role. And you will get an error. You do not have permission, right? So the first thing you got to do is assign someone, whether it's yourself as an org admins or someone else who's going to manage that, permission to create unscoped top-level roles. So that's what you run. And when you run that, it would error because I have already done that, right? So that's expected. Let's do this. Now we just exit out of that and start a new session. So now I have proper permissions. What you notice when it starts is you see this and you would see the progress bar up top. This is when it's evaluating the permissions and then giving you the commandlets. So once you have that, yep, right place. Okay, so we start that. We're going to expect those errors in the initial phases now. All right, and now you see that I tried to create it. If you see how I'm breaking my own script, is I did the first one that's supposed to show you it failed, which it failed before. Now, since I already have permission, it succeeded in the first time. I was able to create the unscoped top level. And then, of course, this is not going to work because it's already assigned. And I try to run the same one again, it's already done, so it's going to error, right? The next one is the commandlet you want to assign to someone, right? So this is where I have created that script already, a custom script that's going to create a user account, a mailbox, certain password. It is only going to be created in a certain mailbox database. And it's really simple. I'm not trying to do anything fancy, but it's just an example, right? So what I did here is I said create a new role entry that allows access to this PowerShell script. And the next step is you want to create a group that is going to give people access to what you just created, right? So that's the next step. What, where, who. So this is who. Who is going to have access? You're creating that, and when you create that, what you're going to see is in Active Directory, you will see a new group. And then you can go and add users to it. So the role group is created. We are going to actually add a member. I think that might be wrong, but let's see. I think the user is only called Help Desk, not Help Desk 1. Yeah, and that's fine. I can take care of that manually. But basically, you get the idea. What we are doing is we are giving permission to this help desk user to the commandlet. So let me show you what that looks like. Oh, come on. Okay. And now I just gave permissions. What we are going to do next is I'm going to show you what that looks like from the user perspective. Okay, so what I just did is logged on as that help desk user on my regular machine, right? And I'm going to start PowerShell. And I wonder if, did I create a script? If not, that's okay. Give me just a moment. That's the default of demos. It always works, right? Just one sec. Ah, there we go. It would help if I was looking in the right place. So I have that connect Exchange script, the stuff that you already know, the two commandlets to connect remotely to Exchange. What you see here, and if you remember this experience from what you have already done before, what you expect is it would show you the exported commands in the brackets with the dots because you have too many. What do you see here? Just one, right? That guy has access to only one commandlet. That's it. Doesn't have anything else. So if I want to show you what I can do is just type here get command. And if you haven't tried that, you should. Basically what you're doing when you connect to Exchange remotely, it basically on the fly creates a module, a temporary module, and it imports all those commandlets. That's the module, TMP and some name. So I always search on TMP star and it gives me all of them. Since I didn't connect to anything else, that's the only one that exists. And instead of showing me a lot of commands, it shows me only one, a PowerShell script. I cannot run anything else, right? And let's go ahead and create a mailbox. Right? That's all that person can do. In the back end, however, that script might be doing 10,000 things. So unscoped doesn't mean the person has access to everything. Unscoped means you as an administrator can define what that person will have access to. So that way, your script can be restricting everything to a single database, and now you just scoped it to a database. Right? Even if it's unscoped, you just scoped it by using that script for a given database. All right, and that concludes our demo for that one. Let's go back to that. You might have questions. Let's just hold it to end. I'll answer all the questions. I'll be available. When you create the scope, so we just jump on from the roles to scopes. What are scopes? Scopes are, it allows you to access what you have access to, whether it's OU, whether it's servers, whether it's set of users based on their title or something else, some attribute. You're using that to define what they will have access to. As a user, when you assign the user policy, I mentioned earlier, as a user, you only manage yourself. So that is also a scope. The scope is self, right? It's a dynamic scope, and that automatically evaluates who you are, because when you say self, for you it might mean your name, and for me it might mean my user, right? Okay. One thing I do want to mention, in the scopes, you have two scopes, write scopes and read scopes. You can restrict write scopes. You cannot restrict read scopes, right? That's one thing that has been asked of a lot of times. It's not possible today. Will it be possible in future? Don't know. What I do know is the read, the problem with the reads is the impact on Active Directory. When you're trying to restrict the read scopes, you first have to read the whole structure of your directory, forest and domains and objects. And then once you do, you're trying to restrict the reads. So the transactions that are going back and forth with AD, the way I was explained, if I'm right, is a greater impact than we would like to have on your environment. Especially in the bigger environments, it would be very bad to do that kind of LDAP queries. So the read is not restricted. Role group members are basically, we talked about role groups. The role group members are basically the people you add to it. You have commandlet for Exchange, so you can just run the commandlet. Instead of going to Active Directory to add someone to that role group that you just created, you saw in the unscoped label, I just run one commandlet, and that one commandlet added that help desk user to the group that I had just created. It's an Active Directory group. It's an Active Directory user. You just performed an operation that an AD administrator would otherwise do, right? So without leaving your Exchange shell. So, now, that Exchange Security Groups OU, how many of you have actually noticed it was created once you installed Exchange? Or do you just let Exchange work? Most of you, like me, would have gone and see what it did in Active Directory, right? You would have noticed on your root domain, if you had multiple domains, and if you had single domain, you would see it in the domain itself, that Exchange Security Group was created. It's an OU, and all the groups, including the role group we just created, would exist in that OU, right? So as you go and create more role groups, those role groups would be created in that OU. You can move that OU itself. How many of you had a question where somebody said, hey, can I move this OU somewhere else to a different domain? If you were in the multi-domain architecture, sometimes people shuffle things around, especially the AD guys. They love to organize stuff. So they move OUs, move it from here to here. And no blames to anyone, right? Businesses change. You have acquisitions. You have different requirements than you had a few years ago. So you're moving stuff to map it to what you have now instead of what you had before, right? And when you do that, the question comes up, what if I move this OU? Would it break RBAC? Would it work, right? The answer to that is if you move that OU, entire OU itself, it would work because the other well-known objects on the org is modified when you move that. When you do the drag and drop in Active Directory in the back end, the processor are taking care of the other well-known objects attribute. And that's basically pointing to where that OU is. So wherever you moved it, even if you accidentally dragged with your mouse, it would know where it is at, right? So it would work. It would continue to work. What if you didn't want to move the OU, you just wanted to move the groups inside it? You could do that as well. The only thing that is not recommended is don't move some groups. What people say is, well, Exchange came with these groups. I don't want to touch them. I created these groups. I want to move them over to my custom OU. Don't do that, right? Because when you do that, what happens is unpredictable. I don't know what's going to happen. Don't try that. Well, you can try that in your lab, see what happens. Just don't do it in production. Trust me, we've done things and we've seen things that we would rather not. We would rather be sleeping or doing something better than fixing the problems we've seen. Role assignments. So now you have role, you have group, right? How does it work when you join them together, when you assign the permissions to the group that you just created? So that's the role assignment, as simple as that. You can create the role assignment. You can assign the scope if you want, or you can just leave the scope out and it would inherit the scope from its parent. So if the parent is built-in group, the scope is org-wide. If you created a custom role and it had the scope assigned. When you create another child or when you do the assignment, depending on the role that you're assigning the group to, it would use that scope. Now, of course, you can assign your own scope if you want. So that's an option. Now, this demo I'm going to skip because we did that in the previous one. I showed you how to basically create a custom role, right? Same steps, except instead of unscoped top level, you wouldn't use that parameter, and it would create a regular role. Now, of course, it would ask you one more thing at that point. It would ask you who the parent is. Define the parent and move on. All right, the two quick warnings. Watch out for things like this. View commandlets, usually view commandlets are harmless. Well, depends who's looking. If it's no, then that might be questionable. Right, but the problem is, like I said, you cannot restrict the read-only scopes today with Exchange, right? There are some commandlets, especially the one I've listed here, view AD server settings. What it allows you to do is if you have a forest with multiple domains, you would notice that when you log on to EMS, it automatically scopes you to your own domain. It's only a view restriction. It's not the actual restriction of what you can do. That would be decided by the scope. Right, but this is just where you can see things, where you can see the objects from. View AD server setting has a parameter that allows you to view entire forest, which means you can see everything in your forest, all the objects, and see what they have, which ones are mailboxes, which ones are distribution groups, and so on. And it's important not to remove that because when you assign someone custom permissions and they launch Exchange Management Console in 2010 or EAC in 2013, they're going to use this to see what they have access to and what should be surfaced. So when they go to recipients and what they see in the list is based on their ability to see based on their scope, but at the same time, EAC has to pull everything in to see what they have access to, right? So you would immediately notice if you remove that in EMC, it would give you an error. EAC doesn't. EAC is not MMC, so it's not gonna throw that kind of errors. The other thing is RBAC scopes. We talked about moving OU that was Exchange's own where it stores the groups. But what if you created a scope for a given OU and you say any object in here, help desk can modify them. And then sometime over down the road, you decided to move that OU somewhere else. When you do that, how is RBAC going to know where that is at? Depending on your Active Directory structure, you might have deletion enabled, right? 2008 R2, it allowed you to do undeletes, right? So it has the deleted items folder. Your OU might end up there because it has been moved, which is copy and delete operation. RBAC doesn't know which one's which. What you should do if you move the OUs that are scoped is update the RBAC scope. Make sure your scope is pointing to the right place. All right, behind the scenes, Exchange Trusted Subsystem. Did you ever assign permissions to Active Directory for ETS? Yes, you had to do it manually? Yeah, HMC is a totally different beast. It's a valid answer. It's a valid answer because it's HMC. If it is a non-HMC deployment, a regular deployment, you don't assign that permissions. When you run Exchange setup, those permissions are assigned for you, right? Basically, that's how it works. What is RBAC doing? RBAC is actually looking at what permissions you have from application perspective. But when it translates to Active Directory, it's not modifying the DACLs, right? You are not modifying the ACLs on the objects. What it's doing is when setting up Exchange, it gives it wide range of permissions across AD. They're well documented, so it's not a blank check to Exchange guys. But it has a lot of power. It can create users, it can create groups. In certain instances, I think it can create OUs. Right, so all those permissions are you as a user creating that in management shell or EAC or whatever. Once you do that, Exchange takes that from you. RBAC says, well, yes, you have permission. That's why you were able to run the commandlet. Now I'm going to pass that on to Active Directory to do this work. I'm going to log on to Active Directory as Exchange Trusted Subsystem, right? Your server dollar that is member of that group, that's how it works. And that's in a nutshell, behind the RBAC, behind the scenes. When you install Exchange, you would notice all those permissions are assigned, and you can take the deltas and you would know all those permissions are listed in TechNet articles as well. The point is, it's all done with a system of, there is an OU, Windows permissions OU, right? So Exchange Windows permissions. Exchange Trusted Subsystem is given access to Active Directory objects to create the users and groups. And from that point on, anytime you do something in Exchange, you cannot go to Active Directory and say who did what. Right? When you look at Active Directory audits, if you're used to that 2007 and 2003 mentality and you go to Active Directory to see who did what, you're not going to find anything except Exchange Trusted Subsystem. That's the guy who's doing all the work, right? If you want to find who did what in Exchange, what would you do? Use admin audit logs, right. Exchange 2010 RTM didn't have the admin audit logs turned on by default. Service Pack 1 onwards, it's default turned on. And it doesn't use the custom mailbox like the RTM used. So that was, in my mind, it was a big problem because you can define a custom mailbox where it's going to store the admin audit logs. You as an admin, who's going to stop you from going in that mailbox and delete stuff, right? So Service Pack onwards, it uses the hidden mailboxes for the system, and it stores everything there. It's not completely off limits, but it's not easy to get to. So as an admin, if you're really, really determined, well, you have the keys to the kingdom, right? But that's really for someone who's trying to do something and hide their tracks. Otherwise, you can go to admin audit logs and just see which actions were taken, who took those actions, when it were taken. Okay, so we discussed that, right? A trusted subsystem has access. AD is not the right way to look at the audit information. Split permissions. How many of you actually have deployed split permissions in Exchange? Which ones, RBAC or AD? Both? Great. That is awesome. Which one do you like more? RBAC split? Yeah, I was shaking head because I'm not surprised that you chose RBAC model or the customer chose RBAC model. And you'll see pretty soon why. Basically, split permissions are where you're saying who can do what. And who can do what not within Exchange, that you did from the roles and scopes and assignments. But in terms of your identity management versus Exchange, who can create users? Who can create mailboxes? Who can manage mailboxes? Who can manage distribution group memberships? Two different things, right? Active Directory groups, users, memberships, they should be done using identity management. Let's say that is the mandate for you. Using the default model, you as an org admin will have access to create users, will have access to create groups, will have access to manipulate groups. You don't want to do that because the mandate is you're not allowed to. As an Exchange guy, you shouldn't be able to. You achieve the split between that boundaries, organization boundaries, two ways. Either use RBAC or use AD split permissions. Right? So let's look at the RBAC first. What happens in RBAC is you as an org admin will go in and remove your existing groups that gives you access to create users, create permissions, the groups. So users, groups, ability to manipulate them. All the security principles, right? You remove that first, then create a separate one and assign the permissions only to those who are responsible for it. So let's call them the AD group, right? When you separate that, now the Exchange org admins won't be able to create users because RBAC says, well, you don't have permissions to do that. You as an org admin still have access to assign yourself or others permissions. Remember that delegating org-wide? It allows you to assign those permissions, but what you're going to do is not assign those permissions to any of the Exchange admins. Only assign those permissions to Active Directory admins. And then create a second set of permissions that allows you to enable mailboxes. So the two commandlets, new mailbox, enable mailbox. The difference is new mailbox creates new user and a new mailbox. Enable mailbox takes existing user and creates a mailbox, right? So it gives you access to create anything within Exchange boundary, not in the AD boundary, right? And that's the soft split, as I call it. From the RBAC, you're separating the permissions. It's honor-based system, right? Your Exchange Trusted subsystem still has access in AD, but it's honoring that you are doing the right thing. It's assumed that you're doing the right thing. If you don't trust that model, then go to the next one, which is AD split permissions. Now, this is the hard split. When you set up Exchange, or if you didn't do it when you were setting up Exchange, you can do it later, run the setup with the AD split switch, right? The switch allows you to separate those permissions. So what happens is when you do that, first of all, it creates a protected OU. You see that protected group OU on the slide? It creates that OU. It moves the Windows permissions group to that protected OU, and it does not give Exchange Trusted Subsystem the permissions that it did in Active Directory. So ETS does not have any permissions in AD. No matter what you do from Exchange in RBAC, what permissions you give in RBAC, you won't be able to create users in AD because there is no permissions in AD for Exchange Trusted Subsystem to go and create anything or manipulate the user group memberships and such. I have one word for that, painful. If you deploy AD split, it will be painful. But if that's the main day, you want to really separate and you don't trust the different entities because it's not about trust, but it's more about accountability. That what if somebody just really does that? How do you prevent them from doing that? I'm sure there are a lot of discussions in NSA about how to protect SharePoint migrations now on, right? And a lot of other things. I mean, same discussion. How do you prevent something either after it has happened or before it actually happens? The idea here is before it happens, right? Use the hard split. Use the hard split. It would be painful, but fine. Now you follow the process. Have the form filled out by user. Have AD guys create the user. Tell them it's done. Or maybe even automate that using orchestration. Now one system does one thing, passes the information on to second system. Second system takes care of its own boundaries. And that's the summary of the two, like we discussed, right? What you can do if you're using RBAC split, if you're using the Active Directory split. The biggest point I want to drive home is when you would use RBAC split is if you have systems that rely on Exchange commandlets to do things, right? You can have third-party partner products for archiving or these or that that rely on Exchange commandlets to do things in AD. Well, AD split is not going to help you in that case. Those products will not work, right? So that's where the RBAC split can help you, if it fits within your requirements. If it doesn't, and if AD split is a requirement, well, then you're not going to buy that tool. And if you already bought it, too bad. All right. Yes. Distribution group memberships. Are you looking at RBAC or AD? I might be wrong, but I believe it's distribution groups as well. We'll just verify. You might be right. You can manage the distribution groups fine. You just can't manage the security distribution groups. Okay. Right. So the way you modify the distribution groups from Outlook is different than you modifying it from shell as an admin. And that's why one works, the other one doesn't. Yeah, because ECP, as a user, if you go in your options, you're using ECP. That's same as using the shell. You're issuing those commandlets versus Outlook calling the RPC and then going to AD. Right, in the first line. Yes, the create and delete, manipulate is the right word. Poor choice of words, sorry. Thanks for pointing out though. Yeah, it's not distribution groups then, I might be wrong. But Link, before we jump in, any other questions? I know I'll take questions later, but if there is any like burning quick question, I would entertain that. We're actually closing up on time as well. Link is small. Relatively small, so I'm not going to bore you to death with Link. How many of you actually manage both Exchange and Link? A lot of them, right? Great, and I used to do the same. How many of you have customized Link permissions using RBAC? Few. Great. All right. So the biggest difference between Exchange and Link is it's not exactly the same model, right? Your tools work a little bit differently. When you log on to Link server and when you fire up Link management shell, it's local. It doesn't actually go through the RBAC framework. If you launch the Link control panel, it does. If you connect to Link remotely using regular PowerShell or Link management shell, remotely from other machine, not from the Link server itself, it actually uses remoting, goes through RBAC framework and make sure the permissions are assigned. So what that means is you want to make sure your Link servers themselves are properly protected. Who has access to them is important, right? Other than that, it's similar concept. You go through the RBAC, it evaluates what permissions you have, gives you access to those commandlets, and then you can perform your tasks. I think there was one more thing that I think I'm forgetting. Yes, in Link, you cannot be as granular as Exchange. In Exchange, you can remove the parameter level access. So you can give them access to a certain commandlet, but can remove parameters from it. In Link, you cannot do that. So in Link, you can create a role, remove or add commandlets. You cannot remove or add parameters from a given commandlet. The other difference is you have parent and child relationship in Exchange. Here you have some very loose relationship to that. So you create a role, you select the parent, and it brings those commandlets. Basically, it makes a copy of it. But then you can add more commandlets that weren't part of the parent if you want to. And that's different between Link and Exchange. Connecting is similar except your URL is a little bit different, right? URL/OCS PowerShell, you provided the credentials and connect. Role group members are members of Universal Security Group, just like Exchange. The difference is in Exchange you have that commandlet to add members to the groups. In Link you don't. So in Link you create the role group and then the USG is created in Active Directory. You just go to Active Directory and add users to it. There is no commandlet to add users to that group that you just created. And that's why if you installed Link, you would remember the first thing when you install Link, it says, go ahead and add someone to the CS administrators. By default, it's empty. What happens in Exchange? The person who is installing Exchange is added to it automatically for the first time when the org is created, right? So that's the difference. Okay, and a quick demo, and that would bring us to close. I'm just connecting, so give it a second. And not really as fast as we would want it to be. Okay, it decided to show up on a different screen. There you go. Okay, and the commandlets are identical, a little bit different in a way that Link has everything dash CS for your OCS, right? Communication server, and then the commandlet. So what we are doing here is we are creating an admin role. Well, actually, we're not creating an admin role, sorry. The first one we did is we're only getting a role and looking at all the commandlets, right? It's only showing what commandlets that particular role has in it. What we are going to do is from here, if you look at certain commandlets, there are two commandlets, disable and enable CS user. So I'm looking at what commandlets I have and then what I'm going to do with it. So I have these two commandlets. What I'm going to do with it is remove them based on the definitions I have of the role that's going to perform its tasks. The next one is we are creating a role. You see the template instead of parent, right? Because it's just a template. It's a copy. We are creating a copy from whatever we use as a template. So we are creating a help desk role. Gives me an error because I might have already done that. Didn't find the group. Let's not worry about the error itself, but the next one, what we're going to do is, let's assume that admin role we were trying to create using the template is created. The next thing we're going to do is remove those two commandlets from it, just like we did in Exchange. Remove the commandlets we don't need. The syntax is different, so you would see commandlets at in the bracket, remove equals. If you want to add, you would just substitute remove to add, and it would add more commandlets. You will have to define which one. So here, we are removing those two again, error, because the first one didn't create. But it would have worked if it was right, and it would remove those two commandlets. Now we have a custom role, right? That's all we were trying to do, create a custom role. Now we have a role that is identical to the previous one, but doesn't have access to those two commandlets. And so we quickly switch back to the deployment planning. What I want to talk about in here, it would be quick. I hope I had more time, but basically, this is the cycle that I want you to live with. When you leave here, I want this ringing in your head. What it is I want you to understand not how commandlets work. You will easily find that. In TechNet, you would easily find that in references or even in my slides when you download them. What's important is start with thought process of what your roles are that you're trying to map to, what the requirements are, and how it maps to the built-in roles. Because you would see the built-in roles have lots of stuff in it. Sometimes your help desk doesn't necessarily mean the help desk that's built in to Exchange or Link. Doesn't necessarily mean what it has access to is what you need to have access to. Your definition of help desk might be totally different. So what you want to do is take a look at what's available from Exchange. Use it if you can, by all means. That's why it's so many roles provided, right? You can use them. But if you need to create something totally different, then don't use the existing ones. Just create one either on scope top level, I showed you the power of that. You create the custom ones based on the parents that are built in. And map it out. The biggest problem with RBAC deployments that I have seen is no documentation. So you have custom roles, accidents happen, the roles get deleted, and you have no idea what scope was being used, what commandlets were modified, what parameters were removed. You have no idea whatsoever. It could be as simple as an Excel spreadsheet that lists the group, the permissions, which commandlets were in there, which ones you removed, and maybe even better, one step further, just write down the commandlets that you used to create those rules. Now, if accidents happen, you just copy that, paste it, run it again, and you're back in business. Right? The discoveries, this one thing I hate to tell customers, and I'm lucky it has never happened to me, is that a customer came to me and said, I have that role missing and I created it based on something custom. I have no idea what that was. Because at that point, my answer would be, sorry, I cannot help you. If you don't have documentation, there is no way for me to know. Now, maybe one thing you can do is go to Active Directory and do an authoritative restore. Because in case of Exchange, that's where it's stored. So if you deleted something and if you had backups from AD, you could probably go back to that. Try telling that to your AD admins. okay, with that, takeaways are surveys. I need your feedback, whether I did good or whether I did bad. I need to know either way. I have more sessions, and I don't want to bore anyone. If you're coming back to my sessions, great. I don't want you to, you know, be bored if you didn't like anything. I need to know what I did good, what I didn't do good, what we did great as the event, of course. But this one's a three-question survey. I'm sure it would take you more, not more than 2 minutes. If you do that, that would be awesome. And there are a couple sessions I want to recommend. There are two of mine tomorrow, and there are a couple others in the morning as well. I don't have the slide I wish I had. Not enough time, so sorry about that. But how is the conference so far? Nice, great. Okay, that's what I want to hear. All right, questions, bring them on. I would take the questions on air, off air.